Mr. Anderson, good morning to you.
Good morning. Please report.
You may approach.
Thank you. This is an interesting case, I think, because you took the Stevens case, and I sort of see that there's a common thread there, and maybe that's why you took them and bypassed the Court of Appeals to come right to you. Because one of the two issues in this Onstott case is about premarital house. Mark Onstott owned the house for 9 years before they got married. They were married for a long time, and then, of course, it went up in value. The question becomes, what is active appreciation or passive appreciation, comparing looking at that Stevens case, in which that man had a concrete cement business, was very actively involved in the business that went up in value a lot, plus the real estate that he owned. And so in this case, though, it's a classic case that a lot of homeowners across the state have, and that is, you live in a house, it typically goes up in value. Have you done anything really to the house in order to consider part of that marital by virtue of the fact that it went up in value? Maybe you just shingled the house. Maybe you just had a hail claim or something like that and fixed it. Does that make it active appreciation? I don't think so. Neither one of them were house flippers. They weren't working on the house, anything like that.
Counsel, who yes. had the burden of showing the non-marital interest at the time of marriage?
The burden is on us.
Okay. And what is in the record that shows what the non-marital equity in that house would be at the time of marriage?
I think the record shows that Mark Onstott testified that he paid $58,800 for the house, and that he thought that it was worth $100,000 at the time of the marriage.
Was there any evidence from your client as to whether there was any mortgages against the house? And if so, the amount of those mortgages at the time of marriage?
All we have for evidence along those lines was he took out a loan for about $48,000 9 years prior. I think he testified that he thought he had paid it off. I doubt that his memory was that good, because in reality, if you have a loan for $48,000 for 9 years, you're not going to get it paid off.
And if your client did not testify that it was paid off, the non-marital equity then would be unknown at the time of marriage, correct?
It would be unknown, but I think at the worst case scenario, it would be what it originally was.
That would be an assumption, because
yes,
he
be
could have taken out subsequent mortgages, refinanced, done a lot of things between marriage and the date of marriage, correct?
That's correct. Okay. There was no evidence of that.
Thank you.
And so then the other issue, of course, is about the alimony. And that's also a very common thread with Stephen's case, Section 362, with regard to a mentally ill spouse and what you do and what you can do with that. Because, yes, 365, generally speaking, is about alimony. 362, you folks in July, when you issued the Stevens case, you saw how statutorily it's possible for a district court judge to look at that and consider other factors, per se, about what the support should be. You have to look at all the circumstances of both parties, not just the one party who is mentally ill. And that's why evidence showed that Mr. Onstott presented and showed that when he retired, because he was done working at the railroad at that time, his income dropped. Even though the court had initially said that the alimony was $1,500, even though there wasn't any sufficient evidence with regard to what her needs really were, he presented his evidence that showed in reality that he was terribly upside down by that, and he's exhausted a lot of his own personal premarital or inherited property to even get this far on the case.
Counsel, how did the trial court arrive at the number $700?
I want to say it was kind of out of the air, but the closest thing was that there was a testimony by the guardian ad litem in connection with what they projected the expenses to be, the largest of which was a $650 estimation on what our future medicine bills would be, prescription drugs, although the evidence showed, and we showed that in our brief very clearly, how that was very speculative, and in reality, it was probably $85 a month, not the $650, and I think the judge, therefore, grabbed a number that was going to catch most of that $650. So in reality, what we think is that because of the fact that it was $1,500 a month, when he was having income of $3,000, but with the alimony, his expenses were $5,200 a month. He was going upside down, backwards so far. It was too high of an amount back then.
That was the temporary alimony
correct.
That you're talking about, right?
That was the first temporary, yes. And then we came back a year later because his dissolution had been going on so long after he retired and asked for a reduction at that time because of his retirement and because of the fact that Maria at that point was drawing disability. So she had additional income as well. So what was going on then was she was actually making more money than he was. And one of the expenses that she chose to have was live in an apartment, although they had a rented house that she could have lived in. But she just didn't want to live there. She wanted to incur an apartment expense instead. And then lastly, when the question came up in connection with this continuing support, it's about the 362 support, she started to live with somebody else. And you'll see that the question becomes on the cross appeal in connection with whether or not the judge was allowed to consider cohabitation as a condition for receiving the mentally ill. Now, we realize that cohabitation is a legitimate type of consideration for the court on a regular 365 type of alimony determination, and I suggest that there shouldn't be a double standard in connection with mentally ill spouses.
Counsel, when you say it's a legitimate consideration, it might be at a modification, correct?
I think it would be originally as well as by modification.
Doesn't the Else case say specifically you should not include that in the order?
I think the Else case says that the financial conditions of both parties count.
Well, it specifically struck that language from the decree in that case, didn't it?
I couldn't speak to that. Nevertheless, what happens is because cohabitation could be an issue, because we didn't get that far, but in the process of one of the hearings, while this thing began to be on appeal, judge said sort of proactively, if you will, that cohabitation could be a factor. Rightness is a question. I briefed it, so did Ms. Binning. We hope, quite frankly, that the court doesn't find that it wasn't right, because we think in this case and maybe many other cases, it would be good to sort of find out now what the court feels in connection with that issue, or we'll be back here again. But nevertheless, I'll reserve the rest of my time for thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Binning, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the court. Your Honor, I come here today representing a very seriously mentally ill person, Maria Onstott. My name is Robin Benning, and I was court-appointed to represent Ms. Onstott. Ms. Onstott suffers from a very serious mental condition. She was unable to testify at time of trial and found to be an incompetent witness at time of trial. Ms. Onstott was appointed a guardian ad litem throughout the proceedings, as she could not make the decisions herself with regards to the divorce litigation. As we approach the issues that are under appeal before this court, the first issue that counsel addressed was the issue with regards to the family home, which I'm going to term the Platte River House. That house was an issue at time of trial, is an issue on appeal. Your Honor, there was an entire breakdown of the plaintiff's evidence at time of trial in that they never showed a premarital interest in that house. As the court has rightfully pointed out,
didn't show the interest or didn't show the value of the interest?
Well, two things, Your Honor. They did not show the value at the time of the marriage, and they did not show the encumbrance at the time of the marriage.
So there's no dispute that the husband owned the property before marriage. It's just a dispute about proof of marital premarital valuation.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
The court cannot be expected to set a premarital value to the house if it doesn't have the evidence to do so. And there was not sufficient evidence before the court. The trial court acted absolutely appropriately when, with regards to the evidence before it, it took the value of the house at the time of the divorce trial, He subtracted out the encumbrance that was in existence at that time and divided the remainder in half. There was no abuse of discretion.
Counselor, did you ask that the house be refinanced within 60 days, or how did that come to be part of the decree?
Your Honor, there was not a request that the house be refinanced within 60 days.
With his level of income and $700 a month in alimony, is it reasonable that he can refinance that house in 60 days?
Your Honor, we believe that he could refinance the house in 60 days to get the equity out to pay my client. Barring refinancing the house, he certainly could have placed the house on the market for sale during that time period and paid her portion of the equity. The 60 days is very likely tied to the fact that my client was very remains very seriously mentally ill and requires the amount of money that would come from that house to live, very frankly. And that really brings me to my second issue, and that is one of alimony. In the temporary, Mr. Onstout was employed. He was employed with the railroad. He worked full time. He'd been employed for quite some time. Over and above that, there was also other income from a rental. The court took all these facts into consideration on a motion for temporary, took into consideration the fact that my client had very serious medical bills, no income whatsoever at that point in time, and awarded $1,500 a month to be paid to her in alimony or continuing support and maintenance under the statute.
Counsel, do we have a record? I'm sorry to interrupt. Do we have a record, though, of the temporary as to what the evidence was the judge considered?
No, Your Honor.
Then how can we make a determination one way or the other without an adequate record on the temporary?
Exactly my next point, Your Honor. I don't know that you can. I don't know that you even can consider that, although it was a subject of appeal and I do touch on it. I don't know that this court can make a decision with regards to whether there was an abuse of discretion on the temporary.
As to the ultimate alimony award, what's your view on that?
Your Honor, at time of trial, there was a guardian ad litem that worked very closely with Maria Onstad, helped her with her finances, was intimately aware of her expenses, of her living expenses, and he testified at time of trial as to what he had personal knowledge of with regards to those expenses. The $700 a month that was awarded to her, when we take into account all this evidence came in at time of trial, when we take into account the retirement portion of the retirement that she would be getting, together with her disability, together with the alimony, did not cover her monthly expenses. Although at time of trial there certainly was speculation on the part of plaintiff as to maybe she isn't going to have to pay the some dollars a month for her prescription drug expense. There was never any evidence except what the guardian ad litem testified to. That was the only actual evidence that came before the
court.
But
you're not cross-appealing that the alimony is too low?
No, Your Honor, we are not. Given the facts of the case, totality of the circumstances, we are not cross-appealing that. We are cross-appealing the language that was used with regards to cohabitation. That is the only cross-appeal.
And there was no evidence that there was cohabitation ongoing at the time?
No, there's no evidence that there was cohabitation. The issue of cohabitation happened after the decree was entered by the court. Trial happened, decree was entered, and then the plaintiff brought before the court in a motion for reconsideration the issue of cohabitation and argued that Ms. Onstad was cohabitating with an individual. That's the only information that the trial court had.
But there was no evidence to that effect?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, may I move now to my cross-appeal? As we look at this cross-appeal, and we've looked at the evidence and, most importantly, the case law, the trial court found that there were conditions upon which Maria Onstad would lose her support. And those conditions were that she's no longer mentally ill, that one of the parties dies, that the court enters a further order. All of these three are certainly supported by both case law and statute of appeal. And then the remarriage of the defendant. In other words, someone else becomes legally responsible for this individual. Those were the conditions in the decree. We accept that. However, the court added another condition, and that was that the continuing support and maintenance would come to an end if Maria Onstad cohabitated with an individual. And we would argue that the case law does not support that finding. It's not that it would be evidence in a modification. This is a trigger that would stop the continuing support and maintenance. When that was put into the order and the decree amended to reflect that, that we believe is outside the case law of the state of Nebraska, something that has never been found to be the law of the state of Nebraska.
So for purposes of this litigation, as you stand here today, you are taking the position that there was nothing in the contemplation of the parties at the time of the decree regarding cohabitation. And there's no evidence either that it existed or that it was about to come into existence.
That is what happened, Your Honor. There was no contemplation.
And the reason I ask that is to be clear that if we buy into what you're saying and it turns out later that there is cohabitation, you couldn't come back and say, oh, if we all knew about that at the time.
Your Honor, I believe that if there would be cohabitation, it may be evidence at time of modification. However, we do not believe the law supports it to be a trigger that the continuing support and maintenance comes to an end simply by showing the cohabitation.
Was this an amended decree to add cohabitation?
It was an order that was entered by the court post-decree that added that language to the decree.
And how was it brought on? Was it a modification?
No, Your Honor. It was brought on by motion by the plaintiff for reconsideration of the evidence, and that's when it was argued.
The equivalent of a motion to alter or amend the judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
It was filed within the 10 days of the original decree.
Further, and I see I have very few minutes, we believe that to have this trigger to take away continuing support and maintenance upon a showing of cohabitation is against public policy. And for that, we would simply show that Maria Onstad is seriously mentally ill. She doesn't make her decisions. She's not going to make her decisions. The record shows that she suffers from delusional thinking, from dissociative thinking that is dissociative from reality. Maria is not going to make good decisions. And if she makes a bad decision and she cohabitates with an individual that doesn't add to her financial situation, it would come to an end. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 2 minutes and 25 seconds. Mr. Anderson.
Serious mental illness is, of course, a vague phrase naturally, and we appreciate the fact that there was a guardian ad litem and there is a professional conclusion to that effect, and we didn't resist that. But unlike the Stevens case, this is a case where Maria, she lived independently, she drove, she shopped, she socialized all she wanted to, she was never hospitalized, she didn't even attempt to file for disability of any kind until after the... So in reality, quite frankly, it's not the same situation. I think there has to almost be a sliding scale, if you will, because she wasn't able to live independently. It wasn't like she had nursing home expenses had to go with. She is choosing where to live and who to live with. Then finally, just my last point was about that Vanguard $100,000, because during the time of the marriage, there was a buildup of $200,000 from his Union Pacific Railroad employment, and she gets half of that too. And I don't think that the court took that into effect in any way, shape, or form. And so therefore, as far as financial constraints, no, she didn't really have a lot of financial constraints, not needing some money right away, having the house financed right away. And in this world of refinance, maybe it's speculative, but no, we don't think that Mark really could have borrowed the money. He would have lost the house that he owned 9 years before they got there. So thank you very much for all your time. Any more questions? Otherwise, I'll bow out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.